So today we have a supplemental episode. I am in the middle of editing a very hefty Farsight episode, which will be broken up into two different pieces that go over the most recent lore from the book. The review is already on Newscast, so you can read everything there. There's a part two that's going to be coming up this weekend. Happy Easter. At the Discord, we used to actually have an event for Easter during one of our narrative campaigns where you would have to go around chasing a small white rabbit in games, and if you managed to capture it or any of its eggs, you got relics and stuff like that. I'm really hoping that the new 10th edition that we're learning more and more about is going to allow for that kind of customization. So speaking of customization, today's episode is centered around sept building. We've had a couple mentions throughout the growing number of seasons of this podcast about septs, and I think it's good for a refresher because we can talk about the enclaves a little bit more now. So the word sept effectively means kind of, it's a primary world, right? And the Tau Commonwealth is built up of many of these. It's a little bit more, it's become a more ambiguous number as the editions have gone on. But initially there were only a handful of these. The 8th edition expansion and into 9th, especially 9th, really capitalized on the uniqueness of every one of these primary planets. And along with this kind of colonial aspect where during our crusade rules, you are colonizing more planets. What's interesting is that there is indeed slightly a contradiction of expectation. Right? You are not building really a sept in your crusade rules. You're incorporating new worlds into the greater sphere. So maybe a good place to start might be with the first sept and maybe a loose description of the spheres. So let me just open this up. And yeah. So Tau itself is the planet Tau, which is possesses a large kind of singular supercontinent, very shallow oceans, and several moons. Luvral, for example, was the largest moon and was the first colony of Tau, and is also one of those one of the places where we discovered a warp drive. Now, obviously, since Kelly's retcon, we don't know how warp drives work. I always like to reinforce this. There's absolutely no way that we could be an interstellar empire without faster-than-light travel. It seems in most recent publications that there's a double, tripling, and quadrupling down on the fact that we don't have faster-than-light travel. Yet in the descriptions, it's very obvious that we must, because otherwise it would take, I mean, hundreds of years, dozens of years, decades, or just straight up years traveling between stars, especially the Damocles Gulf. The Damocles Gulf is so vast, for example, that it takes anywhere between 3 to 5 months to travel it using warp drives. So it would, who knows how long that would be going at sublight speeds. So let's just assume that for the sake of this conversation that we have faster than light travel that works between a factor of 5 to a factor of a third the speed of Imperial ships. Okay, so moving forward, this first colony, Luvral, could be considered the proto expectations of what a sept would become. And if you look and reference the stellar cluster that the Tau Empire are in, you see kind of there are descriptions, especially in the Taros book, of how large it actually is, which is 30, excuse me, 300 light years across of densely packed stars. And if you look at the map, you can clearly see that, yes, there are these sept, these bright points of light that each has a name. And then there are smaller star systems. And if you look at those star systems, you start to see like the outlines and the borders of a region. That's one of the reasons why some older Tau enthusiasts like myself often refer to the fact that a sept is not a singular star system. If anything, it's much more like the more feudal system that the Imperium adopts. So, of the, I believe, four quadrillion people are in the Imperium of Man. And I think about 80% of them, or something close to seven, maybe 70% of this is all done through fan math. So I don't think any clear numbers have ever been given, short of the 30K novel that involves the actual Siege of Terra. But hive worlds constitute the major population zones for humanity, and these hive worlds. Brief description of them. Typically, I mean, a planet can have a hive or a proto-hive, something that is on its way to becoming, one of these kind of monolithic or megalithic structures that typically has billions of people living inside of them. Usually, there's an internal ecosystem to it that isn't a nice place to live, if Necromunda is any indication. But amidst these hives, there's an enormous amount of other planets, tributary planets, which then send goods, resources, bodies, people, all to hives. And the hives form a kind of nexus point for administration and control and potentially refinement. Necromunda, for example, is known for its bolter output. That's one of the reasons why the gangs are able to have them, that they're just readily available. So this tributary system is actually very similar to the Tau, except the Tau do it in a way that's a little bit better. Now, out of necessity, and again, this is a little bit long in the tooth discussion, but initially the Tau do not have readily available faster than light communication. They do have rare instances where they can use something called ansibles, which you can read about in Shadow Sun, the last of Kiru's line, Kiru being her father. She is newly appointed to this position of commander, and she crash lands on a world, and her pod, which has her suit and several drone configurations inside of it, is also has a very rare ansible attached to it, which she can then communicate directly to Anva. So it's that level of rare. These aren't typically assigned to everybody. Who knows what why? It could be for a variety of reasons, but let's just say that faster than light communication is expensive and rare. The Tau actually rely on the if you look at the messenger ship from Battlefleet Gothic, it's kind of like a system like the Pony Express, where these ships do quick translations in and out of the warp, or excuse me, skim off of the warp, arrive in a system, broadcast a series of signals, receive signals, and then move on its way. And it's part of a very vast and complex network, sometimes way stations, sometimes modified capital ships will have a similar a suite of communication, stellar communications, but it's not reliable, right? It's not. It's let's say if the Inner Empire, which is the first and second spheres, and we'll get to that in a second, is 300 light years across, and we're looking at a factor of five, factor of three for a Tau skip drive or gravitic drive, you're looking at many months for information to circulate throughout that network. And so, And so what was created at the dawn of the first sphere expansion, and this is after the Tau solar system was fully colonized, this would also be after the first contact war with the Nicosar, which were discovered at the edges of the system. One of the few examples we have of just Tau straight up going, kind of reacting, and we don't know very much about the conflict, other than we know it was a miscommunication of some kind. It's very vague in the Battlefleet Gothic book, but after that conflict, Taun, which was I believe is the closest habitable system to Tau itself, was highlighted as a place to colonize. The orcs were in the way. The orcs from the onset have always been kind of the nemesis of the Tau. The entire region, the stellar cluster that the Tau cohabit, is and to a lesser extent remains to be still kind of infested with orcs. Obviously, in more recent decades, Shadow Sun has resoundly defeated them, and kind of broken their influence in the area. But we still have a quarantine zone just to the southwest of Tau. But Taun, which by the way means basically second Tau, or you know, if you extrapolate that, kind of new Tau, had to be campaigned for. It had to be fought for. And those initial colonizers had to really struggle in those earlier years, maybe even generations. But what it does is that, because even at that point, Taun was a certain distance away, and unable to directly communicate with Tau for instructions, as you would, you know, kind of in any regular sci-fi science fiction universe, communication is key. Because they didn't have that, and because of a combination of other limiting factors that the Tau experience, everything that they send out into the void to colonize, to explore, to fight, to conquer, whatever, all of it has to be relatively self-sufficient. And we see evidence of that across the range, especially, and I always highly recommend, and I've mentioned it a couple times, read the Taros book. That actually goes into describing how individual Fire Warrior units and Pathfinder units are able to operate in the field, kind of it's probably being a little bit hyperbolic, but indefinitely, they are able to rely on Devilfish, which they have, you know, moisture evaporators. They have field rations and kits. Their backpack, for example, recharges the battery cells for their weapons, things like that. The Tau are very good at long range excursions, and no less than their ships themselves. In fact, at this point, the Corvatra, each ship is kind of an individual town almost. I think the easiest comparison is actually Star Trek, where the Federation ships have nurseries for children and have, you know, they do have weapons decks and things like that, but then they also have hydroponic farms and entertain, you know, there's all sorts of things on a Federation ship. And it seems that is loosely described for the Corvatra. And because of transit times and probably the greatest limiting factor, and that is that the Tau lifespan itself is really between, you know, 50 and 60 years. The number gets thrown around a lot, what we do know is that they age quickly into adulthood. So a period of, you know, I think a decade, and they're more or less fully grown. Again, there's a little bit of contention there, because you have novels like Fire Warrior, which state that Shasla Kais was 18 on his first outing, but then you have a couple xenobiologist books and stuff like that describe very quick very quick quick adulthoods, and then pretty healthy lives. The Tau are known to be able to assimilate like poisons and toxins into their system very well. Their heart is also a liver, so and then the water casks themselves get further upgraded in order to handle hostile environments, food, and obviously poison because they're the diplomats. So, but at the end of the day, the Tau kind of are expected to there's a cultural retirement age of 40. Whether or not everybody takes that is up for debate. But they generally speaking only live for about 50 to 60 years, let's just say, for at least for the purposes of this episode. So colonial efforts, expansion efforts have to be done at a self-sufficient level, and that is extended to the sept system. So a sept can't really just be formed. We're seeing more evidence of that, obviously, as we get into the third, fourth, fifth, and rumored sixth expansions. But at least at this early stage, growth was slow. And that's because once the initial colony was seeded, it would then take time, right, to grow big enough to then have supporting tributary installations and colonies. So in the same way that Tau relied on its moons and outlying planets, so would Tone, and then so on and so forth as we stretch further and further out. Now, why is that similar to the Imperial system? Well, the Imperials do the same thing. Now, the Imperials do have faster than light travel and faster than light communications, but it's unreliable. Ships arrive before and after they leave a system. There's vagaries of the warp. People can get lost. It's not as bad, it seems, as kind of there's a lot of areas of reliability. Two human star systems that have regular trade between each other start to form these kind of currents as ships you know kind of use the same tract of warp over and over, so it makes like a groove. So travel becomes a little bit more reliable between human star, well, traveled star systems. But a hive planet, in order for it to get there, typically means it's the sacrifice of the ecosystem. And again, you look at Armageddon, you look at Necromunda, you look at Aggrellon, all of these are miserable places to live. And the hives really take their toll on the planet itself, to the point where you can't really live outside of a hive, and living in a hive is unless you're living at the very highest levels, pretty miserable as well. So it doesn't really seem like they have reliable farming techniques or food generation. Obviously, everybody knows about the extent of human cannibalism in Warhammer 40,000. So any one hive world probably needs, between two or three or more agri worlds, and agri worlds are kind of harvest hellscapes where both animals and kind of freak plants that have been modified by the Adeptus Mechanicus are kind of let loose on an ecosystem. It's pretty. It's it, the description in the rule book of an agri world is actually pretty frightening. Similarly, you have outpost planets, which are very often military in orientation, resource worlds, mining planets especially. A hive world is very much like Rome, right? Where Rome had all of these, there are people that describe going to Rome and that you could smell it before you got there, and that you would see these pits and these mines on your way into Rome that were just filled with slaves and this this kind of stink coming up from the earth as they dug it open. I think that's the inspiration for hive worlds, that they're terrible places that draw on a lot of resources in order to survive. In fact, and again, keeping it within the scope of the Tau faction, Shadow Sun's relatively simple plan to topple hive worlds, because a hive world is also unimaginably defended. I mean, you have the raw numbers of its population, but then you also have tribute, you know, kind of regiments of Imperial Guard or planetary defense forces, and very often probably a close relationship with any number of the different factions within the Imperium. Attacking a hive world is suicide. Gazkull could, you know, has attacked Armageddon twice, and I think rumored to a third time, Angron before that. It's no easy feat, and yet you look at the Tau, and we've taken, I believe, two hive worlds within the span of a decade, and that's because Commander Shadow Sun kind of just. It's a little bit death Ripyika, right? It's a death by a thousand cuts. All she does is attack like a mining world like Taros, perhaps a resource world like Typha 4, which was a had a pro, you know extensive Promethium refineries. All you have to do is attack the belly of the Imperium, and it starts to turn against you, well, or turn against itself. So. Where that differs from the Sept system is that a Sept builds up over time, generations typically, and in its buildup, it makes sure that it is self-sufficient because it has to be. It can't rely on transports coming from, in this case, from Tau to Taun. It can't rely on a convoy because that convoy could come under attack by orcs. And so a Sept. Very much like a far-flung colony in the age of antiquity or pick your human historical age, starts to develop its own culture, and is that culture is distinct and very indicative of the necessities of their new surroundings. So when thinking about a sept, you have to think about that aspect. How did it get colonized? How did, you know, what kind of resource were expended? What sphere is it part of? And let's talk a little bit about spheres. The first sphere of expansion was launched, like I said, to grapple with the orcs, and was successful. And as it escalated and started bringing into it, this, by the way, this is around Millennium 37, 502, Millennium 37. So to give you kind of like a idea of what's going on in the rest of the galaxy, you know, the Imperium is dealing with, I believe, the Moira Schism. It's a very schismatic time for the Imperium, probably the greatest since the Horus Heresy. Internally, that is. The Imperium is very much turning against itself. It's just gotten over Gojh Vandire's takeover, the expansion of the Administratum, and then the counter-expansion of the Ecclesiarchy. So it's a rough time for the Imperium, which is probably, again, why the Tau go largely unnoticed as they're in their weakest phase. But this first sphere of expansion lasts for a little bit over 1,000 years. And in that time, you have the Septs of Taun, Deianoi, Borkan, Dalith, Falshia, Viorla, Sakia. All of these are founded. And we do know that, for example, Viorla has several tributary worlds or systems, one of them being Verla, but another of them being Arkunasha. All of these systems and worlds, we as a community have tried to track them. I believe the last number that we came to, let me just check, was somewhere around 185 unique descriptions of different planets mentioned in Tau lore. And obviously not all of these are Seps. They are smaller colonies. Now, getting into kind of the Kronos era of lore, this would be around when Tau were introduced to Dawn of War, and the White Dwarfs leading up to it. We also then get introduced to the fact that there are phases. Colonies that start as a phase one might have an outpost. typically earth cast, or water cast, who are kind of feeling the place out. And that and those phases, just like the casts, go up to five. Phase two might get a garrison. Phase three might start getting actual like civilian buildings. And it's phase four seems to be the largest, in which during which time all of the castes are present, at least the let's call it the non-ethereal castes are present. And Kronos is a great example of this. Kronos initially colonized during the second sphere, was a pretty bold initiative when you look at it in retrospect, because it was a colonial effort that was done with an existing major power on the planet. Well, and later we would discover several major powers, but the Imperium had actually already claimed the planet, and the Tau chose to try to coexist with them, with the Imperials being on the east part of the northern continent, and the Tau being on the west side of it. Trade was fairly common. The population boomed. It seems to have briefly had an ethereal on the planet to perhaps oversee the initial seeding, but then there is a 200-year period where there is not. During the events of Kronos, the On that is traveling with Shasso Kais is the first ethereal that's been on the planet in generations. So that's something to be said as well. It doesn't seem like an ethereal presence is risked, probably for good reason. Many of the examples that we have of ethereals being captured, be it the Dalamar incident, which is the events that take place in the game Fire Warrior, but also the xenologist Nidrassi on that is captured. Ethereals go out into, and I've referenced the jet, you know, kind of the traditional Episode One style Jedi before. There are ethereals that kind of go on these walkabouts, and they don't seem to travel with very big retinues. They seem to, you know, they seem to kind of, it's potentially based on the On She book. They potentially actually go kind of in hiding, or at least mask who they are, or aren't always obvious about who they are as they move about the Commonwealth. On She notably, you know, has a cowl over his head, and he hides the nasal ridge that denotes him as an ethereal while he's with the prisoners in Kamora. But these ethereals then go on kind of review, and they look, you know, they look at these outlying colony worlds, but there doesn't seem to be a set there's not a set moment where ethereals become fully involved until you get to what is presumably phase five, which would also be the number associated with the ethereals. At this point in time, a planet will become a major world, even with its own tributaries, its own colonial support. And then it's unclear as to how that colony then emancipates itself from its parent sept and becomes a sept unto itself. I have, in my own works, all fan theories, conclusions, hypotheses, you know, warning right now, but I would assume that a sept might not necessarily want one of its more major systems to become unique, culturally independent, right? In the same way that Canada might not want Quebec to break off, or the United States doesn't want to see California or Texas go away. England doesn't want to lose Scotland, and so on and so forth. These real world examples just help set a precedence. I'm not belying meaning or judgment, but I think that a sept might in many cases not want to lose a major, you know, something that they've invested a lot into. But then you look at some of these planets, and some of them, it just makes sense because of distance. Dalith, for example, of which we know the most about in terms of their in terms of the list of worlds connected to Dalith, we know, I think, over 16 unique different worlds and colonies. That's probably because there's been the most imperial contact with Dalith. But Dalith also became a major colonial motivator for the third sphere. And I'm sorry, I've gotten ahead of myself again. So the first sphere of expansion, let me rewind, please. My apologies. The first sphere of expansion lasts for a little bit over 1,000 years, 502 millennium 37 to 956 millennium 38. And in that time period, you have all of these worlds become prime worlds, and they are strong enough to then motivate. The first sphere stops because of a lack of population, and likely they hit some kind of cultural wall, which happens. No, you can't constantly be expanding. Expansion requires a time of I guess solidifying, right? And then as it catches its breath, it then can go again. So the second sphere of expansion, which is the most famous, and is associated with the hero Puretide, for example, has kind of a monumental filling out of the stellar cluster, and is associated with the Nusepts, Atal, Nudras, Kelshan, Elsir, Tashvar, Vashya, and Teokl. So these are added to the fold, but also more importantly, there are a lot of strong fourth phase colonies which can be added to that list, which would be Kronos, north of Dalith, beyond the Damocles Gulf, as well as Shadreg, which is actually in the Kelshan Sept. Unfortunately, they will in a few years, or just a few decades, will be hit by High Fleet Gorgon and sacrificed as the Tau pull away, and it eventually becomes the Zone of Silence. But also we have we have these interesting periods where Tau colonies actually kind of appear all over, kind of a halo beyond the Damocles Gulf, beyond the Perdis Rift, and that's why it's important to kind of understand that it's not always a sept, and these planets never become septs, not truly. They remain in kind of the state that they're in, or eventually they get kind of exterminated or lost due to war. So these spheres are ages. Remember, so the second sphere of expansion starts at the beginning of millennium 39 and goes almost to the close of millennium 41. In fact, the reason why it ends is because of the Damocles Crusade. So obviously, I'm always extolling the virtues of our faction and how we absolutely and totally curb stomped the expectations of an Imperial Crusade fleet, and there are episodes dedicated to that, forcing the Imperium to come to the negotiating table with an alien species. I really do wish more Imperial players would realize how monumental that is, because it's kind of never happened, other than, I guess, with the Eldar, and that doesn't really count. So in this, we have this idea of ages of expansion and time periods of heavy colonization. And associating your sept, let's say you wanted to design a sept, if you're in the first or second sphere of expansion, that means that you're old. You're part of an older culture, especially the first sphere. These cultures have now, I mean, if we want to put it into kind of human terms, let's see, right? Like, it's several thousand years, 37, 38, 39, 39, 40, 41. So yeah, about 4,000 years of continuous habitation. There's no country that we can really, point to as a frame of reference in the modern age that has that kind of pedigree consistently, right? So these systems are by our reckoning as as real world participants in this hobby, that is older than everything that our modern age has. It would be like if the Empire of Egypt were still, we're still building more pyramids, in the surrounding area. It's impressive. It's impressive. And a sept that, especially a new sept, should have a little bit of explanations of why. Arkunasha was recolonized after Farsight was pulled off of duty and sent to Mount Kenji. It was retaken. It wasn't lost, and yet we don't have the Arkunasha Sept, right? We don't have the Verla Sept. We don't, we don't. There's none of these major conflict zones have ever really been mentioned again, other than they've, other than that they were recolonized. So why? Why does your sept? This is the purpose of this episode is to try to help you form a cohesive and strong identity for your sept. And if it's going to be part of the first or second one, you owe it to yourself to breathe in that kind of historical meaningfulness. It would be like if you're in the United States, it would be like if a new state were to form out of, between, I don't know, New York and Massachusetts, right? Some of the two oldest places colonized by the Europeans. Why does there need to be a new state? And I encourage anybody to give that opinion, or create that opinion, create that opportunity for lore. So let's get into the third sphere, because the third sphere, and I feel the third sphere is actually the most tragic sphere, because it got its own book. Actually, it got a couple of its own books. It got the majority of our lore actually takes place in the third sphere. Fire Warrior is kind of the match that lights it. The Ano Cathlan declares the Treaty of Dalith, the ceasefire of Dalith, to be void as a result of the consistent kind of saber rattling and ultimately discovered to be manipulations of chaos. But all of that is kind of the inception of the third sphere. Now, when we got our second codex, we imbued that initiative with Anva and Shadow Sun. They like we're going to take the fight now to the Imperium because we don't want to take it anymore. After 200, 250 years of these brushfire wars, you finally have the Tau ready. And now again, in the act of wanting to make the Tau a more full-bodied and, let's be honest, kind of grim, darker faction, this was it's kind of alluded that this was done by design, and I'm all for it. Shadow Sun plans, after being awoken and after her victory during the War of Confederacy, she turns her eye to start figuring out, like, okay, how are we going to attack the Imperium? And she takes years to do it. And the best way that she knows how is not the concerted frontal assault that Farsight would be known for. Let's call that the Mont Ka, right? She approaches it with Kaiyun. And Kaiyun works just so incredibly on the Imperium. No, you can find a map of the Third Sphere expansion, but you can see all of these arrows going outward from a kind of central core. And revisiting regions that the Tau used to be in, engaging with older relationships that they have with other races, but also rogue traders. That's another thing. That's a Kissi Mien is alluded to have been taken without a shot. This is one of the Third Sphere septs, because of a human. It doesn't say who that is or what it is, but we know in later publications, such as Kaiyun, the book dedicated to Farse, or excuse me, Commander Shadow Sun attacking the hive world of a Ghrelin, we know that there are rogue traders, And once you read the anthology, the Shasso anthology, inquisitors who have turned over onto the Tao side of things and see things from perhaps their perspective, or maybe an opportunity in the case of the rogue traders. So the third sphere is just packed with narrative. But it's also the first time, it's also, first of all, it's the shortest expansion age. I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, or forgive me if there are kind of conflicting timelines, but basically, somewhere in the ballpark of 7 to 15 years is the third sphere. And that's just because this is where the timeline gets wonky and the official retcon jumps in and all sorts of things. But basically the third sphere is responsible for some of the quickest developed SEPs, and it's good to mention those right now. So to begin with, let's talk about Firios. And Firios is one of those unusual SEPs because it is very specifically conquered. It was taken from the orcs. The orcs, it's an orc world. The Firecast came in, lost a lot of people, and ultimately wrested control of it. Now, even though it's just kind of like a blurb, and it does run counter to other timelines, including Kelly's, but at this point, Shasso Kais is brought into the picture, and he is responsible for kind of paving the way, at least for this sept. So during Firios's taking, or the war for it, that kind of creates the culture that's going to go into it. And it's very, very similar to Viorla, actually. And I wouldn't be surprised if there were a lot of, the three major septs that contributed populations to the northern push of the third sphere was Viorla, and Sakia, as well as Dalith. So these very, very entrenched and sizable populations, are kind of cut loose to go find kind of a new home in this beyond. And Firios becomes very much like Viorla in that it's against the, Viorla defines itself a lot by its initial invasion by orcs. It's a really rough period during its time. It's cultural history. Even to this day, Viorla go out and hunt orcs that might have survived during in a period called the Time of Fire, where the planet passes between its two suns, and the planet is kind of wreathed in these plasmic storms. Typically, it kills everything. Everything on Viorla lives underneath a dome, as a result of this. But the orcs, being what they are, they're a hardy race. The fungal spores of their corpses stay kind of embedded in the earth, and so every now and again, Viorla have to go out there and find them. It really helps define that kind of, not just the hot-blooded aspect, but it gives us something more than that, right? Like it gives us a cultural identity that they are a war culture, and Firios is very much the same thing. Perhaps as the result of so many people dying in the creation of this sept, that is why it becomes a sept. The kind of the moment that the war is done. Perhaps this is an honorific, that because of the blood spilled, and we do know that the Firecast, because of Farsight, the Firecast has a very close association with literal sacrifice for the greater good. Now, the Ethereals are constantly curbing that, as we see in Highfleet Gorgon. The water caste is a little bit frightened of it. The earth caste, I think the earth caste is actually the closest culturally to the fire caste, and that's one of the reasons why they invent things that could blow up in their faces, but they do it anyway. Maybe a little bit like the orcs, as a result of that. Just that, like, kind of like, let's see if it works, and if it doesn't, boom, well, then, there you go. But the fire caste has a very close relationship with sacrifice for the greater good. In fact, Farsight, being the most extreme version of this, in which he promotes martyrdom in the enclaves, and dedicates a whole planet to those who have sacrificed themselves for the greater good. You know, he is the embodiment of the Firecast interpretation of the greater good. So Firios gets its own, and it's very small. You know, again, look at the territories on the map. And Firios is very much one of the smaller. Then you have Kissimian, which was taken again without a shot. Lots of subterfuge. In fact, 2/3 of the gains, you know, and I believe the numbers that are generally considered in what I've seen, you know, if there's about 80 to 100 Tau worlds in total for the first and second sphere, never mind septs, just worlds, then 33% of that was added during the third sphere, and 2/3 of that was taken without a shot. Really, the third sphere represents the water cast's way of engaging. And even though we associate Shadow Sun so much with the third sphere, it's actually the water cast that did it. So remember, there's 2/3 systems worlds, either perhaps alien in origin or more likely human, that turned over to the Tau without a war that we know about, like, again, without shots fired. So that gets overshadowed, obviously, when Agrellon, which is a hive world, is chosen to be kind of the, let's call it, the guinea pig of the Tau interpretation of all-out, total crusade-type war. I've dedicated a couple episodes in the past of how stupid that was. The blame entirely goes to Anva, who showcases new technologies, but also it's unbridled technology and all kinds of atrocities happen. It's actually a really great book. I know a lot of people don't like the Kayun and Mondka books because they're written kind of flat, but that's because they weren't written in the style of Forge World's Taros book, you know, where you really get into camouflage decisions and like a coherent calendar of events. But with Agrellon, you know, Agrellon is a mistake, but it becomes Mugalath Bey. And now to contrast with the other two most famous septs of the third sphere, Mugalath Bey is, first of all, we know it comprises of several systems. Prefectia, which was a fortress world that was taken by Shadow Sun, is part of it, along with a couple other, you know, technically I believe Medusa 5 would have fallen in the territorial footprint of the third, of Mugalath Bey, I'm pretty sure. But all of these worlds are now more spread out, right? These systems aren't, it's not the densely packed stellar cluster that the first and second sphere enjoy. These are far flung, right? So Mugalath Bey, over the course of a very bloody war in which a new crusade is launched under the authority of Terra itself, and Exterminatus is eventually committed against it, Mugalath Bey still exists. At the end of the book, the Hive Primus of the planet survives the kind of the conflagration that the Adeptus Mechanicus unleashes, and you know, the major population center is saved. However, if you note in, you know, later books, it gets a little contradictory because they sometimes say the former sept, or but then they'll also describe that the people of Mugalath Bey specifically hate the Imperium, and that is another aspect of culture that is important to incorporate in your understanding of the septs. Obviously, we know about the first and second spheres. Septs that have animosity toward other aliens. Tashvar, for example, is a frontier sept. It's also kind of strung out pretty wildly. There's a lot of worlds mentioned in the Tashvar sept. And they are considered, kind of frontier people, and they go up against the orcs and pirates a lot, and that really defines who they are. With Mugolath Bay, their experience with the Imperium really it taints them almost, right? And it teaches, and that, that word hate comes up again. And the Ethereals are always, kind of preaching against, don't hate the alien. Anshi is probably the most famous in doing so, because you can't work with hate. Hate nullifies the ability of cohesion and working together. But don't tell that to somebody from Mugolath Bay. I think if somebody were to create their sept, Mugolath Bay is one of the most interesting places to put, or really the third sphere in general, because you have such variety. You have a world that fell in a day, because of smart marketing, good diplomacy, and paying the right people off at the right time. On the other hand, you have hardcore orc fighters who bled so much they were given their own sept. And then you have Mugolath Bay, which had billions and billions of human beings come into the Commonwealth, but then it also is stained by a very recent history of major atrocities. I believe one of the events that happens is that the Earthcast kind of overplays their hand and destroys one of Agrellon's moons, resulting in an entire continent being, just almost wiped out by moonfall. So it's just, you have so much diversity there. And on top of which, because it's in the greater galaxy and the stars aren't as densely packed, you have more reasons why a sept would be able to grow faster, because it has to rely on itself even more. Additionally, it's probably only one star system because it's surrounded. I mean, the third sphere is deep comparatively into Imperial space, more so than Farsight's reclamation would have ever been. But let's talk about Farsight's worlds briefly, because sometimes I see people ask, are the four planets of Farsight septs unto themselves? Now, on paper, yes, the four of them are septs, and you can see that in the most recent Arcs of Omen book. There's kind of a casual mention, the Farsight septs, and we only know about four worlds, I think five actually, and they are, and that's how they're referred. However, in practice, I would like to briefly make the argument that they are smaller than septs. To begin with, Farsight has doubled down on the caste system, in that each world is dedicated, mostly dedicated, to one sept or another. That is not something that septs generally do. Now, just like the spheres, which have associations with a caste, like. And I've talked about this before, but the first sphere is definitely the air castes, the air and the fire castes sphere. That's where they come into their own. The air caste suffers enormously trying to. I mean, imagine the orcs being more technologically advanced in almost every engagement with another species, and that's what the Corvatra had to fight through. The fire caste realizes, after hunting the mega predators of Tau. Now they have to go up against a sapient race that that just is everything they kind of abhor about the ways to wage war, nor no quarter, the kind of the thrill of combat versus the kind of cold and calculating state that fire warriors typically want to be in. They don't always stay there, but you know what I mean. Then the second sphere is a combination of the fire caste and the water caste. But the water caste's greatest failing takes place during the second sphere, and that is that they weren't able to subdue the orc. And it's the first admission of the Ethereals that the greater good is not for everybody, And that's a big cultural blow to such a bright-eyed and bushy-tailed species as the Tau. The third sphere, as I've said in this talk, is very much the water caste's kind of return to the main stage, major victories all over the place as a result of their work, the conversions of billions. I've said this again before, there's probably more humans in the Tau Commonwealth than there are Tau at this point. And of course, you can say that the third sphere could be some of the fire cast, although I actually like to give it to the ethereals. This is the third sphere is the ethereals' first big outing, leading from the front, and it ends in disaster. Obviously, spoiler, Anva is assassinated, although I'm not sure if they're going to keep that anymore because of the more latest Arcs of Omen book where. Well, man, that's another episode for another day. But anyway, it is, and as we go forward into the fourth sphere is just is a failure for the caste system in general, and the fifth sphere is most definitely the fire castes. Really, the fifth sphere is there's no question. Diplomacy fails largely, the air caste. Kind of plays second fiddle to the fire caste's initiatives and so on and so forth. But septs also adhere to a flavor of caste. Viorla, obviously, and Tashvar both rely heavily on their warrior culture, as does Sakia, while Deyanoi associates strongly with the air caste. Tjolk'u and Borkan are both earth caste oriented septs, while Tau itself is the only place where the ethereals like congregate in vast numbers in the White City. But that said, every sept is has its divisions, has populations, regardless of emphasis. In the enclaves, those worlds are almost completely one caste or another. And so that's why I don't like to call them septs. They're something else. If anything, I think that the easiest thing to be would be to come up with a word for the Farsight enclaves, which, could be something like Shovashiru, which would be Farsight fortresses, or perhaps even Shovaord. Or Ord Shova, which would be worlds of Farsight. You could have some a word like that, and that these 4/5 major worlds that we know of. I keep saying five because there's also a Gwevesa world, but it doesn't indicate if it was Kleist or Garrus or if it's a new thing. It's just kind of slapped on there. Similar to New Catachan in the Leagues of Votan book. It's just like, oh yeah, and humans are here too. Really, the enclaves are their own sept, in my opinion. But on paper, the individual planets orbiting four different star systems are individually septs. So that's the third sphere. The fourth sphere, like I said before, is largely a failure. Although, again, the people that are taking most advantage of the fourth sphere are actually game developers. The Gladius game, for example, the Fantasy Flight card game, to a lesser extent, the Leagues of Votan, actually, the Leagues of Votan book even has this out there, and does the Blood Angels Codex, where you just have it's kind of a carte blanche, taking advantage of the idea that the Tau fleet was scattered while in the warp and came out at different times and different places all over the galaxy. So yeah, you could absolutely have a Tau colonial fleet. And remember, every single vessel, with the exception of the smaller escorts, are self-sufficient. So you could create, you could be blown off course, and arrive to a place. I mean, the Tau of Gladius, for example, believe that there's a possibility that they are the last Tau in the galaxy, potentially, which opens up really interesting narrative possibilities. So yeah, I guess everything that the fourth sphere does, you could say is a sept, no problem. Either way, the fifth sphere catches up with them sometime later, and I will say that they do clear that up. In the Chalmeth books, as well as the Arcs of Omen, and even the new Shadowsun book, which I don't recommend if you can, if you know, but review forthcoming. There are indications that they're going to be there's going to be a little bit more room rather than just a big fleet entered the warp and then exited the warp because of the intervention of a certain greater good goddess, something of which I just for the record am diametrically opposed to, but here we are. The fifth sphere is the most of all the spheres is the most like kind of in a weird way a blend of the third and first in that it's so far away and if you consult your 40K galaxy maps just so you know it is between the Ultima Segmentum's I guess former capital which is a place called a night world called Cardunias and kind of in between there and the Red Scar Nebula or Ball, where the Blood Angels are, that is the location of the Nemyar Atoll. And the Nemyar Atoll, it seems like it's in a densely packed area. There's lots of stars. There's already several SEPs that are there, and they are forming the hubs as they push outward. But very much like the third sphere, it is becoming less, and this is probably by narrative design, but diplomacy is not working. The gene stealer cults that are kind of active in the region have duped the Tau several times, and as I've stated before, the best counter to Tau are Sisters of Battle because they actually convert Guevesa back into loyal Imperial citizens, even if they're going to be hung as traitors later. But you have like a three-way war of ideology in the fifth sphere, and so you could absolutely take the opportunity to make a sept out there. However, I kind of caution against it just because that is the bleeding edge of the timeline, and I find it odd that a sept be formed in a year, you know, and obviously, if we had kept the old timeline where it was like 112, 114 years in the future, that was the original timeline, what they were going to keep, I would be much more open to all sorts of things, not just Tau stuff, but also Primaris stuff. It would make more sense that a century of the most insane galactic spanning conflict creates all sorts of new opportunities. But since the retcon, and since now we're only about 12 years in the future, I do find sept creation a little bit like just a little bit it just feels a little bit cheap now. Same thing kind of goes for new Space Marine chapters. Like, I don't like the idea that there's like the Primaris are woken up and then like a couple minutes later, like they have their own chapter. I mean, maybe that's an unpopular opinion, but one of the reasons why I like 40K is it's always steeped in this really rich and nuanced history. And if we don't get that, then I feel like it's cheap. It's one of the reasons why I don't have an opinion on the Leagues of Votan. If they're adopting all of the Demiurge lore, great. But if they're not, you got to give me something because right now, just a bunch of stunties showing up on the border means less than nothing in terms of lore. They need their own book, and it's probably just because they're gonna hopefully we're all going to get big slabs of lore in 10th edition. That's really my hope, and I'm excited for it because the rule system also looks really cool. But that's a general overview of septs, spheres. And my recommendation, again, and I've talked about this before, is instead of thinking so hard about a sept, because a sept shouldn't be just a garrison, right? It shouldn't just be one commander's sept. The kinds of people that are like that are Puretide. You know, Puretide is the reason why places like Tashvar exist, you know? I don't even really think the Commander Shadow Sun is attributed with any other sept other than really Mugalath Bey. I think that, you know, Shasso Kayis with Firios. It's a big deal. A sept should be a really big deal. So as an alternative, I always offer somebody when they're saying, "Hey, can you look at my sept lore?" I always just say, maybe this is an opportunity to revisit your commander, because I believe that Games Workshop should have put that in the creative soup, you know? I think that people should have taken time to build the character and personality of their leadership of their cadre, in the same way that people do it for chapter masters, because the ideology of a Shasso, which we know there are at least seven mentioned meta strategies, but let's just say Kayon and Monka, they have philosophical debates as to what is better. But even more interesting, you can even have commanders like Brightsword back before he was assassinated, where his ideology matches Commander Farsight's, which is, and or was, used to be hyper aggressive. You know, the Imperium is a giant behemoth that we have to start, you know, shiving as we try to survive out here. We have to keep stabbing it until it hopefully bleeds to death. And that's what Brightsword was going to do. He was going to ignite a war before, you know, from one perspective, before the tower ready, and another in a way that would have exacerbated the problem. And you know, the Imperium could have come in with another crusade and hit. And that's why, you know, that's why his assassination was orchestrated. So I would take a moment and really think about your commander. What are their thoughts on conflict and war? Where's their philosophy and ideology stand? You know, Shadow Sun is starting to get acolytes in the same way that Farsight has always had acolytes. The Ethereals, for example, are, you know, someone like Anshi is getting more warlike. Anva made the misstep of being more warlike, and it got him, you know, murderated, or whatever it is that Calexis assassins do to you once they, you know, get you in their midst. So it's just, I would recommend, obviously, if you're going to jump into the deep end of creating a sept, start with the spheres, and that'll inform a lot. I think the hardest to justify is the fifth and first spheres in terms of a brand new sept. And then that's the hardest. And then the easiest is the third sphere. And then of course the fourth sphere. And then the easiest is the second sphere, just because Tashvar is still a frontier sept and is still pushing outward and dealing with stuff. You have a lot of space is big, as always good to remind yourself. And there's a lot of opportunities for those border second sphere septs to be dealing with stuff. Bor Khan is raided by Death Watch and as much as Tashvar is like bumping up against elements of the realm of Ultramar. So, you know, there's opportunity in the second sphere. So I think that might be a good place to stop. And I would love to open up to any questions for those who have come here. We're about an hour, and so as usual, this short episode became long. I'll be doing a couple more of these. To cover things like different individual units. The next one will be about Breachers, and then the Riptides after that.